todo momento. 3 meses de los que subirás ese nivel tanto que, pues, que querrás otros 3 meses y otros 3. Entra en grupobauan.com e infórmate. Curso trimestral de Bauan. Si tienes alguna duda o necesitas información sobre cualquiera de nuestros cursos, llámanos al 91-133-5833. Repito, 91-133-5833.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on this program, I'm going to talk a little bit about the transition between the time of the Habsburgs and the time of the Bourbons in Spain. 2 dynasties and a war in between, the War of the Spanish Succession. And this is in order to talk about reforms under the Bourbons, how things changed with this new Bourbon dynasty. On an earlier program, my last program, in fact, I was talking about the idea, well, the arbitristas, the people talking about reform during the time of the Habsburgs. They were not really listened to. It was going to be later, it was going to be the 18th century where people started paying attention to the idea of doing things right, of organizing things. And yes, that was going to be a big part of what happens in Spain. But first, there was a terrible sort of decline, let's call it a parenthesis, during the time of failing health and no heir, no crown prince, with Carlos Segundo el Hechizado, and fights. I mentioned this on my last program, so I'll go through it just briefly. You did have an Austrian candidate, Leopold I of Austria, who was the brother of the queen, let the queen, well, he convinced the queen to let him marry her daughter, right? Margarita. The one, Margarita is the one in the Las Meninas, right? The blonde one, the cute one. And so she went off to Austria. Now, she died in childbirth, giving him a daughter. And so Leopold was no longer in the picture. It was going to be his daughter who carried the Spanish bloodline and would be the Austrian candidate. He found a good match for his daughter in the form of Maximilian of Bavaria. Maximilian of Bavaria, a good candidate. And Maximilian had backers in the court, right? The queen mother, Mariana de Austria, and Cardinal Portocarrero were very, very strongly in favor of a Bavarian alliance and having a Bavarian king on the throne of Spain. In order to make things agreeable for the French king, in order to convince him, or at least bribe, right, sobornar, bribe him to leave Spain alone or to allow him to have the Spanish crown, well, he was willing to give France territory north of the Ebro River, certainly all of the Basque country and so forth. That was going to become part of France, and also the Italian possessions of the Spanish crown. That would go to France as well. And so the Iberian Peninsula would be fragmented, but at least it would be Bavarian, under a Bavarian king. And this was pretty much a done deal until Joseph Ferdinand died. He died, and all of the plans had evaporated. They were gone, and it was, and so it was, yeah, inevitably it was going to be a French candidate. So, you had Philippe, Duc d'Anjou, Charles II abdicated to Philippe, and Charles died. The Spanish ambassador in Paris went to Versailles and proclaimed Philippe as Felipe V, Philip V, King of Spain, in front of all the French nobility, with the Sun King, right, Louis XIV, and at least initially, everybody thought that it was going to be Louis XIV who managed things from behind the scene, that Spain and the Americas, because this was about the Americas, not really about Spain itself, but about the Americas and what was there, already discovered and yet to be discovered, that all of that would be controlled from the Palace of Versailles, that Felipe was weak and easily manipulable. They gave him a wife who could manipulate him very easily. In addition, well, Felipe, as we will see, he goes crazy little by little. Just completely unroyal. Did not have it in him to be king. Now, on my last program, I was talking about what if, no? Que hubiera pasado? What if, let's imagine that Joseph Ferdinand had lived. Imagine that he becomes José Primero, that, right, the original José Primero was in fact the brother of Napoleon Bonaparte. That was actually the first Joseph I of Spain, not recognized as such. If you look at a list of the kings of Spain, you will not see his name. But he was there. And if there ever is a José, he'll be maybe José Primero, José Segundo. I'm not sure. In any case, the Bavarian candidate would have been José Primero, and the French would have had the Basque provinces, part of Castile, and Italy. But inevitably, there would have been a war, because the Austrian Empire was big, it was expansive, and it would have gone to war against France over Italy, over the Italian possessions. And so Spain would have been untouched by a succession war. On the one hand, yes, it would have lost the Basque country, but it would have kept Menorca. Remember that in the War of Spanish Succession, Spain had to give up Menorca, give it up to England, and, of course, Gibraltar. Those two would have remained Spanish. But no, Puerto Carrero, who was solidly pro-Bavarian, when Joseph Ferdinand died, he switched to the French and backed Felipe Quinto. And so Felipe Quinto arrived. He was celebrated. Castile was very, very much in favor and very loyal. But others were not. There were enemies, let's put it that way. And so in this transition, we have, well, between the 17th century, where the greatest threat had been France, and a land power, in the 18th, all of a sudden, the greatest threat to Spain is a sea power, England. And the Austrian Habsburgs become the main enemy. So it's the world is upside down. Now, in order to wage this war, you have to have an efficient administration. And so it was going to be time for a very, very aggressive administrative reform. Taxation, wartime borrowing, these financial shortages. Naturally, Aragon, jealous of its privileges, of its rights, of the fact that it has to be asked, and it gives taxes voluntarily, right? Aragon, which consists, of course, of Aragon itself, Valencia, and Catalonia, begins to revolt against the demands of the Bourbon dynasty. They are accustomed to centralized government, just the way you had highly centralized government in France. Now, you have early reformers like the ambassador, Jean-Henri Louis Henri, right? Financial expert. And others who believe in the French cause and believe in the rationalization and centralization of the administration, like Melchor de Macanaz, supported, of course, by the Queen, Maria Luisa of Savoy, and the Princess of Orsinas. Macanaz is a hardliner and believes not in the carrot, but rather in the stick. Let's put it that way. Doctrinaire, ferocious, and believing in the king, right or wrong. Now, obviously not just Catalonia, Aragon, and Valencia, but many others saw a threat in the new way of doing things. Los grandes de España, right? The grandees, the old fortune, the old aristocracy. They saw that they were being, that all of a sudden they were old-fashioned, right? They were no longer useful in this new system. They had dominated the councils, the old system of consejos. They had been extraordinarily important and influential at one time, but this was inefficient. And so these people were no longer useful, and they were furious about it. So you've got the grandes, the consejos, Catalonia, Aragon, and Valencia, but not the Basque Country. The Basque Country was from the very beginning, and Navarra, they were fiercely loyal to the new dynasty, to the Bourbons, and quid pro quo, they were allowed to maintain a sort of autonomous system of government. In 1705, Charles, the Austrian pretender, landed in Catalonia and took Barcelona. Philip V marched through Aragon, and the locals there revolted, resisted, and fought against the Castilian troops. This revolt, of course, it was caused or instigated by local nobility. And it turned the king and the king's advisors against a local privilege, los fueros, the charters or agreements. All of these were abolished. The property of people in rebellion was confiscated, and royal will was simply imposed. When the Archbishop of Valencia tried to resist and resist the jurisdiction of civil courts in the name of ecclesiastical privilege. Remember, privilege means private law. So yes, aristocrats, the hidalgos, they always had privilegios because there was one legal code for them and one very different legal code for the commoners. But yes, a military legal code, if you break the law, you are tried in their courts. La Mesta, right? The association of wool export, right? The lana, the laneros. They had their own rules, their own courts, their own jurisdiction. If you broke one of their laws, you would be tried in their court and punished by them. Yeah, these are, this is what privilege is all about. The, Maecenath was allowed to compel the Archbishop of Valencia to obey. But then, Queen Maria Luisa died in 1714. And suddenly everything began to change. With her death, you had the sort of the death of reform. I mean, there were, for example, all the universities in Catalonia were centralized. There would be one central university in the provinces, far away from Barcelona, which could be more easily supervised and observed. But other things were imposed. But the real appetite for reform stopped. And it stopped because, essentially, at this point, Spain went from being sort of French to being more Italian, with the arrival of an Italian queen. And naturally, there was revenge. The old guard always had the Inquisition, right? The Inquisition, at this point, representing forces of reaction. So, yes, the Inquisition at this time was politicized, and the hyper-conservatives were able to use it when they wanted revenge on their political enemies. Now, this war, which was pretty much, it was a disaster for the Spanish Empire, because under the treaties of Maastricht and Utrecht, Spain lost Belgium and Luxembourg and Milan, Sardinia, Naples, Sicily, Menorca, that was given to Britain, Gibraltar, given to Britain. And this broke the right of Spain to a monopoly on the Asiento de Negros and El Comercio, Asiento de Comercio, so that in theory, Britain had the right to send one ship per year to trade in the Caribbean with the Spanish colonies. But in practice, it was opening the door to all sorts of abuse. And in exchange, yes, Spain was pretty much unified. As I say, in exchange for their loyalty, the Basque country and Navarra were allowed to maintain their fueros, but the rest of the country centralized. And from then on, you get basically two kinds of politics. You get a politics that more French-inspired, let's call it that way, that looks out at the big picture, geopolitically, and that is concentrated on Spain's relationship with the Americas and what they are doing there in the Western Hemisphere. But you get another kind of politics which is interested in Italy and concentrates on Italy and it willing to spend time, money, and energy to establish and reestablish a Spanish presence in Italy, what they had so recently lost, according to Maastricht and Utrecht. And so, Philip, again, a product of Versailles, in his youth, he had been the Duke of Anjou, the grandson of the Sun King, and when Louis XIV died, he was part of the succession, right? A candidate, maybe uncomfortable for the people around him, for people like, the future Louis XV. And so they forced him to renounce his claim to the French throne. And placed him on the Spanish one, in part to get him out. As I mentioned before, he was a hypochondriac, did not like water, did not like bathing, smelled very, very bad. He was the one, he slept during the day and was awake at night. So many of his cabinet meetings and so forth took place at 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. And everybody in the court just had to get used to this. Farinelli, one of the last of the castrati, came to Spain. Italians were very welcome in Spain. Farinelli was hired to sing the same four songs night after night after night. He would sing the king to bed. Evidently, the king couldn't go to bed, wouldn't go to sleep, unless he had these, canciones de cuna, something like the, lullabies sung by Farinelli. And this went on for decades. In any case, yes, easily manipulated, and his first wife was French, and she was the one who drove him along a French way of doing things. And very, very solid in these reforms. But as I say, she died in 1714. When she died, he simply lost it, went crazy, refused to attend to any business, and was secluded. And everybody knew that the only solution possible would be to get him another queen. And it was going to be up to Princess Orsini, the governess of his children, right? The woman who was now, 60 years old. She was going to be the one to take it in hand. All right, I have to take a break now. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes with the second part of the program.
Profesionales de su empresa no comunican eficazmente en inglés, su empresa no necesita clases de inglés. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente. Muchas son las empresas españolas que despilfarran el dinero contratando clases de inglés a diestro y siniestro. Café para todos y resultados para nadie. Dominar el inglés requiere enfoque, esfuerzo y un plan. En Baugen Empresas tenemos un plan hecho a medida para su empresa. No nos interesa vender clases, nos interesa conseguir soluciones. Y para ello tenemos un apasionado equipo de profesores formados meticulosamente en el método Baugen. Llama al 911335831, 911335831. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente.
Hey, have you heard about our trimestrales? No? Well, let me tell you all about them. The program lasts 3 months. Eso es, dura 3 meses. Many different timetables to choose from Monday to Friday, Saturdays in the morning. And you'll have plenty of homework. And your teacher will correct your homework and check it to make sure you're making progress. Find out more now. Our trimestrales at Vaughan. Small groups, only 4 to 6 students per class. And the class is focused on speaking and using the language. Contact us and find out about trimestrales with one of our dynamic Vaughan teachers. You won't regret it. No te arrepentirás. More information at grupovaughan.com.
Sin prisa, pero sin pausa. This is the Spanish expression that I use when people ask me what they should do with their children concerning English. Sin prisa, pero sin pausa. The target date for English mastery is age 23. Children and adolescents don't need English, really, until they reach adulthood, until they finish their studies and start looking for their first job. This is usually at the age of 23. If they don't know English well at this point, they are in trouble. They have a problem, an important problem. If they don't know English well at the age of 23, when they enter the labor market, they will probably never reach a decent level, a good working level of English. So, as a mother or father, you need to make sure that your children gain a good command of English by the age of 23 at the latest. This means that when the child is born, you have 23 years to solve the problem. Are you capable of solving a problem if you have a 23-year window to solve it? I hope so. Here in Vaughan Systems, we provide kids, children, with dynamic verbal access to English starting at the age of 4. We expose the children to the native sound of the language, and we work especially hard to promote effective listening comprehension and to make the language fun and attractive for the children. Entrust your children to us, little by little, slowly but surely, sin prisa pero sin pausa. We will transform them into bilingual adolescents and prepare them for age 23. Contact Vaughan Jr.
Más información sobre la línea Junior de Vaughan Systems en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
Si tienes alguna duda o necesitas información sobre cualquiera de nuestros cursos, llámanos al 91-133-5833. Repito, 91-133-5833.
El Máster en Inglés Profesional te ofrece este programa.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on the first part of the program, I was talking about the War of Spanish Succession, the transition between Carlos II el Hechizado and Felipe V, no, de Borbón. The new dynasty, the new style, the French style, and how almost immediately the French style is going to disappear, and everything will be Italian. Okay, so you've got the king. The queen has died. Marie-Louise has died. And the king is inconsolable. He will not attend to business. He will not do anything. This was true. I mean, he had rachas, right? He had moments, bouts of depression. Actually, depression was a constant, but of true insanity, right? Locura. True insanity. And when he simply could not be a king, could not attend to business. In any case, he was inconsolate, and everybody knew that he was going to have another wife. That maybe she could steer him along the right path. Well, it was going to be the Princess Orsini, the governess of his children, and his balida, let's put it that way. She was going to take matters in hand, and she and her compinche, right, her sidekick, I suppose, I don't know, her friend, Giulio Alberoni. Alberoni, if I remember correctly, he was the son of a gardener, right? The only way that people with talent can really come up in the world. It's interesting because you have, in traditional society, right, you have the aristocracy, you have the common people, and you have absolute stagnation. There is no meritocracy. These two, the society is held together, let's say. This division is held together by two institutions. The military on the one hand, and the clergy on the other. The church, and the military. And it's interesting that the church and the military are the only two institutions where you do have a meritocracy. In other words, this lack of motion, this stagnation, right, this inertia, social inertia, is only held together by two institutions that do have a meritocracy, where you can move up if you are talented. Well, so the only place you can move up is either in the military or in the clergy, and Alberoni decided to do it in the clergy. If I remember correctly, I say he was the son of a gardener and just went into military service. He accompanied, I think, his master into France, and because of his mastery of languages. He was very good at languages, and he went to the Prince Vendôme, one of the heads of Louis the XIV's service, and then was taken up by the French, right? They could spot talent immediately and put into the employ of the French and sent to Spain, where he was essentially part of the Italian party. Alberoni working for Italy. And so, Alberoni became like number one in Spain, became the man behind the scenes, the one who manipulated pretty much everything. Yeah, he was the son of a gardener in the Ducado, the duchy of Parma, and was given a superior education and made interpreter, and then, yes, in the employ of the Duke of Vendôme. Right. Now, the Duke appointed him to take command of Spain, and Alberoni was in all of the negotiations there in the court of Spain. So the queen had died. It was going to be necessary to find the king a new wife. He talked about many different candidates, knowing that all of them were unsuitable in one way or another, right? There were big buts, right? Un pero. There were big buts to all of them, right? Advantages and disadvantages, but the disadvantages outweigh the advantages. So, yes. Until he talked about Isabella Farnese, Elizabeth of Farnese, the stepdaughter of his old master, the Duke of Parma. And Parma, what do you get? A cheese and ham. And trying to sell Parma with the cheese and the ham and pretty girls. I don't know, maybe that goes together. But at least at the time, that was how he was able to sell her idea. That, you know, that the local products, at least the local food products of Parma, are so appetizing that the girls are pretty too. In any case, that was actually enough to convince people. He told people that the Elizabeth was docile and kind of bovine, right? Like a cow, stupid, easily manipulated, and that she would be the perfect wife. So yes, submissive. Yeah. Philip naturally approved the choice because his two most important advisors were coinciding in this. And the preliminary steps, all of the negotiations and so forth, they were done in a great hurry to get her there as soon as possible. Now, the Princess Orsini had other sources of information, and she discovered, you know, once everything was in motion, she discovered that Alberoni had been lying, and that Isabel was by no means as incapable, as rustic, as ignorant as she had been told. She sent off a courier saying that negotiations would be suspended until she had a chance to investigate further. The messenger reached Parma on the morning of the day that the marriage ceremony was going to be celebrated. The marriage was done por poderes, right? It was done by proxy. Proxy is what we use when somebody has the legal authority to act for another person. That person is a proxy. And so you vote by proxy, right? In the, el reunión de vecinos, right? You have a decision they have to make. And it was, okay, I have my vote and I have 10 proxy votes. So, yeah. Also in the shareholders meeting, the annual general meeting, AGM, of companies, that you can have votes and you can have voting by proxies. Today, everybody is familiar with the word proxy because of computers, right? Because of computer transmission. And personally, I'm not actually... I just don't know. Technologically, I don't know what they're referring to when they say proxy, right? Your ID, your proxy number. What is that? Some kind of representative? In any case, we are familiar with it, even if we don't know what kind of proxy they're talking about in terms of modern electronics and computer telecommunications. But in this case, I'm talking about a marriage by proxy in the beginning of the 18th century. So, happening in the Duchy of Parma, and the messenger has arrived with an urgent message from the Princess of Orsina to suspend all the proceedings. Now, of course, Princess Orsini had her sources, but Alberoni had his sources as well. At this time, I believe he was a cardinal. Cardinal Alberoni? In any case, he had his sources as well and was successfully able to detain the messenger until the marriage ceremony had finished. So yes, now it was done. Now it was too late. Isabel of Farnese had been put up to date about the state of affairs by Alberoni, and Orsini had to be eliminated. She was now un estorbo. She was now in the way. So, she was supposed to go to Spain. Now, as queen. And all of the royal household was there to meet her when she arrived, when she crossed the border. All except the princess. All except Orsini. Orsini was with the king at the time. Now, he was going to meet her halfway. He had set out for Alcalá. He was going to Alcalá de Henares, right? And then, Orsini decided that she wanted to go even faster, to anticipate this and to meet alone in Jadraque. And they met in the village of Jadraque. The new queen was very, very gracious, but when the princess entered her chamber, she accused her of a lack of respect, of not being properly dressed. Now, the princess was not expecting this accusation. She apologized, but the queen refused to listen to her, ordered her out of the room, told the officer of the guard to arrest her, and to banish her, to send her out of the country. The princess, who of course was dressed appropriately, the princess was put in a carriage with only one attendant, right, a maid, and two officers of the court. She was not allowed to carry a change of clothing. She was not allowed protection against the cold or any money to buy food or lodging or anything she might need along the road. Now, we're talking about a woman who is older than 60, which back then was like saying 90 years old. And we are in the middle of the winter, and a very cold winter. She is being sent. She will be expelled from Spain, pushed beyond the limits of Spain, and she will never set foot in Spain again. And yes, she was a troublemaker, a born troublemaker. She's easily able to manipulate her husband much better than his first wife ever had. And extremely ambitious and impetuous. One, her big goal to make sure that her husband was placed back in the line of succession to the French throne, right? That at least he had a chance of becoming king of France once more. So that if the Duke of Anjou died, that he would replace that Duke of Anjou, and that he would possibly become the French king. And then secondly, her own children would find kingdoms in Italy. Italy that it had to be given up, right? There would be a place for them somewhere in Italy. She kept Alberoni on, at least initially. She kept him on as long as he was useful. Remember that at this time, Spain was pretty much in ruins because the War of Succession had been a disaster, and it was going to be necessary to start everything from the beginning. One of the important things was to restrain from foreign engagements, right? And marañarse, to get tangled up in with foreign commitments. Alberoni was successfully able to negotiate this. But yes, the existing regent, the Duke of Orleans, was unpopular in France, and it was going to be necessary for Spain to intrigue, let's say, and side with the enemies of the Duke of Orleans in order to get Philip's name back into the line of succession. And this led to war. That was the outcome that nobody wanted. The Duke concluded an alliance with England and Germany, which had been enemies of France until that time. And Philip declared war against Germany. Alberoni had been the peacemaker until this time, but there was nothing he could do. Alberoni sent an expedition against Sardinia and another against Sicily. Now, there were all kinds of intrigues for the restoration of the Stuarts, the Stuart dynasty, to the English throne. And so Spain became an official sponsor of this idea of putting the Stuarts back onto the throne of England. Now, because of this, Alberoni was a persona non grata, right? The new king in England, the Hanoverian king, George the First, the German king, hated Alberoni. And naturally, in France, the Duke of Orleans hated Alberoni for what he had done, claiming that he was responsible for disturbing the peace of Europe. And the Queen, seeing that Alberoni was more of a liability at this point than an asset, told him that his services were no longer required at court. One night, this was in the year 1719, Alberoni was in the royal council with the king, concluding business. It was a normal day. He had every reason to believe that he was in full favor and authority. That evening, their majesties, right, his majesty and her majesty, their majesties, the king and queen, left for the Pardo, and from there, sent a decree to Alberoni, depriving him of all his offices and telling him to leave Madrid within 3 days and to leave Spain within 3 weeks. At this time, well, previous to this, let's put it that way, Alberoni had not been popular, right? Somebody so powerful just is not popular. But once he had fallen, he was the object of sympathy. And so all kinds of people, better the devil you know than the devil you don't, right? This is what we say in English. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't. They thought this fulminación, right? This downfall of Alberoni was symptomatic of worse to come. And so, yes, he was the object of sympathy, popular sympathy, but also sympathy among the nobility and clergy. And so all kinds of people went to visit him. And the king was very alarmed at his new popularity, because, as I say, previous to this, he had been unpopular. And so Alberoni left. He went to Rome. But of course, now it's a question of you can run, but you can't hide. And so even in Rome, especially the French wanted him put on trial by the Pope and cardinals. And he was, of course, able to defend himself. And naturally, the Pope was very reluctant to be seen as being so easily manipulated by the Duke of Orleans. So what happened was they ordered him to retire to a monastery for 3 years. And of course, once the publicity had passed, this sentence was reduced to 1 year. And subsequently, the Duke of Orleans died, which meant the man had no more enemies. And immediately, the Pope said that he could leave, and he retired quietly. Alberoni lived happily ever after. You can see somebody going from extremely low beginnings to the height of power, falling into disgrace by doing his job, and finally, at the end of his life, you know, you just wish that he had written more about himself, about his times, giving us advice about how to handle people as capricious as the ones you could find at, for example, at the Spanish royal court at this time. All right, speaking of time, I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Nuestro curso online es único por una sencilla razón. Nuestros profesores son los mejores del mercado. Richard Vaughan, Ximena Holiday, Kyle Miller, Alberto Alonso, Richard Brown, nuestros All Stars desde cualquier lugar. Por menos de 30 céntimos al día. Quédate en casa y aprovecha para poner en forma tu inglés. Entra en la web cursodeinglesonlinevaughan.com e infórmate. Pruébalo durante 2 semanas y si no te gusta, te devolvemos el dinero. Cursodeinglesonlinevaughan.com, porque hay muchos. Pero solo uno de Vaughan.